At the very end of Pauline Kael's delightful critique of the movie on the first circle, we have this comment, which will fit into some things that come. Nearly 2.5 years ago, Raytheon Company announced a prototype furnace that the company said could heat an entire house, even though it was no bigger than a cookie jar. How'd you like that, huh? And none of the little family were cold, as the New Yorker said. There you get a false sequence, a little house no bigger than a cookie jar that can be heated by this new heater. And that's the kind of humor, the grotesque, that you've got going for you under Solzhenitsyn. And there is humor here. I hope that some of you will buy, sometime, the first book we ever published. There's a little humor even in Howard Hong. He gets the National Book Award as a translator, and he has this delicate genius that comes through in this beautiful briefie that we published way back when, Humor, Satire, Irony in the Comic. And one of Howie's favorite jokes is about the fellow who tried a glass of water with a glass of whiskey and he got drunk. So then he tried a glass of water with a glass of brandy and he got drunk. And then he tried a glass of water with a glass of bourbon and he got drunk. No question about it, it was a glass of water. And that's just about the humor that you've got going for you in Solzhenitsyn. You're guilty, and there's no question about it, because you're a Russian. And if you're Russian, it's proof enough. You're guilty, that's all. You belong in the Gulag Peninsula. And if you aren't in the cancer ward, at least you've got to be down there in the first circle. And this is the irony of it. And it's more than that, because it has a double kind of play in it. Because the only hope that is in the Russian novel as such, and which Solzhenitsyn sustains, the hero still in the Russian novel. It's not Nazarin in the first circle. It's none of these figures that come. The hero is the Russian soul. And Dr. Zhivago is dead before the end of the novel. The hero still is the Russian people, the suffering out of which will come redemption, not only for Russia, but hopefully for the world. And this is a continuous theme for the Russian novel, and Solzhenitsyn still is in that. He is a Russian writing for Russians in this theme that out of this suffering comes hope. Pauline Kael takes this through in her very fine critique in The New Yorker, January 20th, 1973, The Current Cinema. She is reviewing Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The First Circle as a movie. But the critique that she makes is the identical one made against us Lutherans and our passivity, that we don't have power, that we believe that it's adequate, that the Christ who changes the person will change the world. It's the identical kind of critique that comes over against Jesus Christ. He should have called on the legions of angels at his control and not have taken the cross. That it's the way of suffering love that will be the redemption is Solzhenitsyn's constant theme. And in this, he is a Christian novelist. In fact, one of the great Christian novelists, and one of the great Christian novels of all time, is certainly The First Circle. She says a kind of an old-fashioned Russian Christianity that comes in. And it does have that quality. It occurs around Christmas. The action takes place with 4 days, from Little Christmas Eve until the day after Christmas, really. And it's in the Christmas setting that we have the conversations that make up the novel. The plot is very simple. A man in the Russian Foreign Service is aware that a professor whom he loved as a student is going to be seized and put into the Gulag Archipelago because he has been seen talking when he was on a mission in Paris with a Parisian, a Frenchman. And so unquestionably he's guilty. If any Russian is seen talking to a foreigner, there can be only one reason why, and that's to betray Russia, naturally. So therefore, he should be seized. And since he knows this, he has to tell him finally. He wonders, should he? Is there some way they've got now of finding out what voices are like? He doesn't know. Actually, the men who are the zeks in this particular very plush kind of a concentration camp are the outstanding mathematicians and scientists in Russia, getting a little special treatment, food, and so on, to carry on particular researches that Stalin has asked. And what he wants now is a voice detector, a detector that will know who you are by your voice. And that's being worked on. And so the part of the plot situation is this research that's going on, as this particular man who really disappears in the novel. He comes out a couple times, but never very much, and finally at the end he's seized. And then the men who are performing the service with themselves revolt and are taken to another prison, which doesn't have any of these privileges. And yet in their soul is peace, as Solzhenitsyn closes it. The kind of a context then that in which this particular novel occurs has the same kind of a humor that we see in all of Solzhenitsyn's writings. Cancer Ward, for example, has this unforgettable phrase in which the previous head of the cancer ward has been consulted by the now head of the cancer ward. She's a woman, and she suspects that she has cancer, and she decides only one she can trust is the man who formerly headed the institute. And he is aware that she does have it, and he says that it's the peculiarity of modern man that in all his maturity, he is not mature enough to confront his own death. And this is the ultimate joke. So you transform a whole world and a way of living together and go through revolution and set up a whole new state, and you aren't able to confront the one thing that's sure for us all. Some of us may miss taxes. I didn't have to pay any last year. The one year when the government hands something back, it would be the time when I didn't have to pay because our losses were greater. Now they're trying to find that my losses aren't so great, and they'll finally have to pay me some money, and that's another kind of a reverse English joke, isn't it? But death is sure, even if taxes aren't, isn't it? And if that we can't celebrate and that we can't confront, we certainly are all the most miserable men, and we just haven't got it made, have we? And that's the basis of our conversation, actually, between the Christian world and the communist world today. It doesn't give you much comfort to think that you're suffering and hurting that 10 generations from now they might have a withered state and the proletariat is in charge under the withered state. In the morning you can go fishing, in the afternoon you can hunt, in the evening you can read a pleasant story with your friends, which is the image of paradise for the communist world as it was depicted by Marx and Lenin. After all, if you're in prison and all you've got is a suffering because you dared to say that the mustache, what does he think, and that's all you say, and you get 10 years for referring to the mustache. That's what Solzhenitsyn got, as you know. And you're guilty if you're Russian. This is the joke, isn't it? And the awful irony in the joke is that you're guilty not over against Germans, which might have some plausibility, or Japanese would have far greater, but by your own countrymen you're guilty. They're Russians too, so therefore they must be guilty. And in a queer way, in his novel, this is played upon. And you sometimes wonder who's the prisoner and who's the jailer. In fact, as Solzhenitsyn makes very clear, the only really free people in Russia are those who have nothing more to lose. Because where the state has made its great mistake is that in taking everything from a man, his mobility, his dear ones, his correspondence, his life work, they have taken from him everything, so he has nothing to lose except his life. And the livability of that's already gone, so he is free. He's the one person who is free. And therefore the conversations are interesting. You're hearing the actual people, not is somebody listening in, so I never dare really say it. One of Baton's little stories from Russia, which he says has truth in it and is very likely true, is of a father who brought his child to be baptized, and the priest refused to baptize. Leo will be bringing up, and I'm going to stop talking about it so he can start his, this very situation. Solzhenitsyn was angry because when he took his child to be baptized, the priest wanted to have a visa from the state so this man could enter paradise. You know, you've got to have a special kind of a permit for a baptism, and he was furious that the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church went along with this. The Archpatriarch, who wrote him a letter personally in Moscow about this. Well, here this father's bringing his child to be baptized, and the priest refused to baptize it, and he's furious. It isn't because he doesn't have a slip or anything else, but the priest says, I can't baptize this child. I baptized him 3 days ago, and the mother brought him. When not even a conversation is possible between a husband and wife. And this is the bleakness that's there. Now, some people feel this is overdone. It may be possible in certain remote rural areas that this is so, but as Solzhenitsyn tells you about in Gulag Archipelago, they spend a million rubles and put hundreds of men to work to find the guy who mutilates his ballot in one rural area. Finally, they get him. In Solzhenitsyn's novels, there is no hope because the police machinery of the state is that efficient. They don't give up until they find him, as the man with the voice recording. And the end of the first circle is picked up. He comes into the prison as the others are being taken out. And then a foreign correspondent watching the traffic in Moscow is much impressed and writes to his home papers about how fine the living conditions are in Russia because everywhere you see meat vans. And of course the meat vans are covered and they're what they use to carry the prisoners from one prison to another. Leo? So you see the kind of humor, the kind of gallows humor, black humor, but it's there.
The reason that I often wish to have Solzhenitsyn discussed here is to hear Carol expound on it. I don't really know much about Solzhenitsyn, so it won't take me very long to tell you. But it's interesting how, to some of you perhaps, how I got to where I am. Well, it may not be interesting at all, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Because I'm sure a lot of people say, you know, what's with these Russian novelists, names you can't even pronounce, and what have they got to say to us? It's true that a few of them have made headlines lately. When I grew up, I didn't know about them, and I didn't really care. We were raised on a farm, and we had a lot of things to do in addition to getting our studies done. But we had to read something to get through English because Mrs. Tunham was really rough and tough. And I was very efficient as a lad, and I counted the number of pages in the various books that were assigned and the credit given for them. We have to have 15 points. And I found out the most credit for the fewest points were in Shakespeare's plays. So that's about the only thing I read in English. Because for the fewest pages, I got the most points. And I became quite familiar with Shakespeare's writings, but hardly anybody else except Black Beauty. I remember her. So I was essentially ignorant of these things until a fellow, Paul Sponheim, came to Richland, and some of you people remember that. And one of the best things that Sponheim did for Richland Lutheran was he got a lot of people reading. That's what also happens at Holden, and that's the reason for this afternoon's session. One day, when I was finishing my PhD at the University of Washington School of Medicine, I was in the latter stages of it, and I was commuting between Richland and Seattle, and I left the driving to them. I went by Greyhound bus, and I'd often spend long weekends there finishing up the research and my thesis, and I'd catch the number 4 or 7 or something at the University Medical School, ride it down and get off the Greyhound bus depot. And one day, I happened to look up shortly after I had boarded the bus, and a man and his dog climbed down the front of the bus. He had a big pouch with him, and he wasn't on the bus very long before he opened up the pouch and he began reading. It was a very large book, and of course in Braille. And he was going along there pretty well until he got about 3 blocks before the bus station. He closed it up and began getting ready to get off. I sat too far away to see what he was reading. And so I thought, well, I got to find this out because I'm attracted to characters. And fortunately, he was getting off the Greyhound bus depot too. So I quickly got off the bus and went up to him. And by this time, he's approaching the corner. And I asked if I couldn't help him cross the street. No, he says he was quite familiar with it and he'd make all right. But he did get confused at the corner, and so I went up to him and I said, well, I'm going over anyway. And so I went across with him. And I said, I was very interested in a couple of things. about you. I noticed, for one thing, you got up, you start closing up your book about 3 blocks before the bus depot. How did you know that was the time to get up? And he says, well, if you remember, there's a slight jog in the road there. Well, I hadn't remembered, but then the next time I went on it, I remembered, and it's a slight jog in the road. So he knew something I didn't know. He knew another thing I didn't know, because I asked him, most interested in knowing, what's that book you're reading? And he says, it's Brothers Karamazov. He says, it is the most important book ever written. And he says, I read it every year. And I said, boy, that must be really something. And at that point, I always chalk these things down. I says, all right, the Russian novelist, I got to read. And the story goes back then to about 1849, when a Russian writer was questioned by the secret police. And he was questioned because he had heretical thoughts. And he was imprisoned. He was of course, had been alerted. The police had been alerted by a secret informer. And he was taken to one of their secret police's prisons and there interrogated. And then he was, he was really led to the scaffold to be hung. But as he was reaching, as he was approaching it, his sentence was commuted to life imprisonment in Siberia. He was there for a time, and then he was brought to Central Asia to spend the rest of his time. A place which I won't name for you because I can't pronounce it anyway. And he then wrote a book. It's called The House of the Dead. And then he wrote many other books. In 15 or 20 years, he became very famous. His name was Dostoevsky. He also wrote Brothers Karamazov. And it is interesting for me to realize that about 100 years later, I should say also, because the sentence, because of there was a change in regime, he was then released. But his health was broken by his 10 years of imprisonment. It was 100 years later that another young writer was imprisoned, informed by an informer in the secret police, who was also taken for interrogation to a large prison and taken to Siberia. And there he had a very difficult time. His health was broken. And as a result of this experience, he wrote a novel called One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which caused him to become very famous because it was the only one of his books that was released in Russia. And you sometimes wonder why it was. But of course it was, again, a change of regime. And as a result of this change of regime, he had his sentence commuted, and he ended up in the same place that Dostoevsky ended up 100 years before. So it's a very parallel situation and a very interesting one. I related very much to Ivan Denisovich because I too had been in prison, but not like that. But he did have a remarkable description of cold and hunger. Carol and Mary can tell you more about hunger than I can, but I can tell you something about it, and how he relished the food, and how it had to be warm, and how you eat it slowly, and it's a remarkable description. But the most remarkable thing about it for me was the description of the cold. When I was in prison, one of the things I promised myself was that if I ever get out, I'm never going to be cold again. And that's why you always see me with two pair of something on. I won't go in the plunge. It's too cold. I'm not going to be submitting myself to that. Many people wonder about Solzhenitsyn's Christianity. And certainly it's very clear in Ivan Denisovich. There's an insignificant character in it named Alyoshka. And Alyoshka has the secret. He's the free man in there, as Carol pointed out, because he hasn't got anything to lose except one thing, and his secret is in the gospel that he reads every night. It has nothing, the freedom that he has nothing to do with barbed wire, the terrible conditions of the camp, or anything else. It's a remarkable book, and I recommend it to you. As a result of his experiences, you see, Solzhenitsyn had several degrees, and it's in mathematics is where he started. And it was as a result of this that he did spend, I think, 3 or 4 years in one of these prisons where they were really doing the mathematics as described in First Circle. So he was really then talking to us from his experience. And then he had cancer, they'd taken off a lump, and then it came back. And then he was taken then to a cancer hospital, and hence the story of the cancer ward. And it's worth reading. It'll really shake you up. In the publisher's foreword to this, they say, this then is the setting and the background of the cancer ward. Like Dostoevsky a century before, Solzhenitsyn is passionately on the side of the poor, the oppressed, the insulted, and injured. Passionately devoted to his native land, and passionately concerned with good and evil. This book is offered to the reader in the conviction that, like Dostoevsky's work, it will take its place among the classics of world literature. And my Russian teacher, after all this, I decided a few weeks ago that I ought to sign up for a class. I always encourage my associates to sign up for a class, and so I announced to the surprise of my associates in my office the other day that henceforth on Tuesday afternoon in our seminar room they would have coffee and tea available at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because my Russian teacher would be in there for Russian 495, which happens to be Gorky and Solzhenitsyn in English. And one of our assignments is the First Circle. So I'm a little ahead of that game, because I've heard Carol talk about it. Although I think I probably won't take any of the exams. You can imagine, I knew the instructor too. He's a poultry scientist, and he's a Russian. He immigrated to this country. His name is Igor Kozin. And he teaches the Russian novel there. And he really did a triple take when I came walking into the room. And he was grateful that I, since the class was so small, which very surprised me very much, I invited him to our small seminar room, because the chairs in his room were very uncomfortable. And it saves time for me, because I can just walk in and sit down for the class. But he also told me that, in his estimation, the cancer ward was his favorite. I think the first circle is Carol's favorite. And the one that, of course, is most difficult, probably, is the Gulag Archipelago. And it is indeed difficult. And if you can't make it through it, don't feel bad.
I can't.
I haven't made it through it either. But there's one thing you should do in it, and that is to read The Arrest. That's in the early part of the book. And when I get to be dictator, everybody will read the first part of it, The Arrest. Because it really has a message for you. If you've never thought about being arrested, those of us who have, you always ask, you know, how could it be me? Certainly there must be a mistake. But there's no mistake when you're arrested in Russia. Even if it's a mistake, they won't admit it. So I recommend that to you. Now, the day, of course, that the Gulag was released in Moscow, Solzhenitsyn packed his bag. It wasn't released in Russia, but it was announced that it was released in the Western world. And of course, this would cause great embarrassment to Russia, and it did. They, of course, there's only one book released of his in Russia. But the day that this was announced in the Western world, Solzhenitsyn packed his bag, his black bag, and waited for a knock on the door. And he didn't wait long, because the knock came and he was accused of treason and forever banned from Russia, being the second man in modern times to be so accused. The other one was Trotsky. And this hit him very hard. A lot of people said, well, boy, he gets out of that rat trap or that terrible situation. Life didn't have that much. He was not afraid to face that. What he feared the most was to be taken away from the Russian people. And that's what they did to him. And I think the biggest impression that he has made is his view or his concern with the big lie. And in explaining, for example, the Gulag, he said, if we openly admit our terror-filled past and severely condemn it, not just in empty words, then that will only strengthen trust in our country throughout the whole world. He says, it is not those who talk about crimes that have been committed who harm peace and good relations between people and nations, but those who committed or are committing them, because they were accusing him of messing up detente. And then he went on to say, and if our youth, once it has learned everything and understood everything, does not support us, then that would be because of lack of courage. And he doesn't lack courage. By such, and he goes on and he says, and then both it and we will have deserved our sad fate, and we will not be able to complain about anyone, only about our internal slavery. But such support, the writer said, he did not mean any physical acts, but rather a refusal to participate personally in the lie. In our country, the lie has become not just a moral category, but a pillar of the state. In breaking with a lie, we are performing a moral act, not a political one, not one that can be punished by criminal law, but one that would immediately have an effect on our way of life. And in Newsweek magazine, they said, for Solzhenitsyn, truth has always been more important than consequences. And I think that's a great statement. One word of it, he has said, can outweigh the whole world. And then just one other thing, and I'm going to turn it back to Carol. I've been collecting up these things, and there's one, and this was, he published an open letter about who rules the church in Russia. And then, of course, the person who rules the church in Russia didn't answer him. Somebody else did. But they brought up, you know, what can one person do? And Solzhenitsyn then replied, "If there is a future, you say, are we not going to do anything about it? Is that what Christ taught? It is precisely the inward defense of the faith that is gone. It is precisely inward strength that has been lost. Most of all, it is the hierarchy who have lost it. You neglected to point out the main solution, the one to which I appealed, to re-educate the world by means of visible personal sacrifice. One man can do nothing, you say? That's not true. One man can do something. Anyone can." One man can do nothing, you say? That's not true. One man can do something. Anyone can. Did you know anything about me 9 years ago? But today you are going to the other extreme, saying that I can't safely do anything. How did this come about? Evidently, there is a way. You say that I have been surrounded by the silent sympathy of many of my compatriots. Well, is this any less true for the church? Doesn't the patriarch still have millions of believers? Of course it would be wrong to incite people to martyrdom, but may we not call them to the way of sacrifice? Why should you forbid this? And of course he did make, he's a very controversial person. And we came to America and everybody wanted to put him in their mold, but he resisted it, and God bless him for it. Some people wanted to claim him. He embarrassed the president because the president thought it would effect detente if he invited him in, and then he later invited him, and he didn't come. So he has caused a stir. One man can change the world.
That's the word, you see, that Pauline Kael won't accept, and unfortunately, most of us don't believe it either, and yet Yugoslavia has just, I think, confirmed its own great writer in his understanding of Solzhenitsyn, because he said as long as Solzhenitsyn lives in Russia, communism is not safe. And they've just put him in for 7 years. And we've got Scoop Jackson. He doesn't help us very much here. I don't think he talks more about it. But I told him, okay, let Mondale take care of those who suffer from our government doing nothing about their tailing pile. Now they decide it may be partly our tailing pile, and they discover it may cost them $2.5 million to do something about it. But anyway, I told Scoop, we'll let Mondale fight for us and you fight for these guys. Please get this guy in Yugoslavia out of jail who had said this. Why read novels? No, why read novels? See, Hoover didn't. Made fun of those who did. He lost the election in 1932 because of it. He didn't know what was happening. I can still remember it. He talked about two chickens in every pot when you weren't even able to afford a fire. Remember? I mean, it was that stupid. You know, Our last president didn't read them either, you know, Nixon. And they asked him from Hallmark to criticize Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment after Hallmark was through presenting it. This way Hallmark could get it on the, you know, TV by doing this. Fantastic thing. You can't read it, and you couldn't have seen that without being overwhelmed. I live in a Republican neighborhood, and I usually vote Republican for everything except the national offices, as it happens. But I really... Couldn't believe my ears as Nixon summed up this tremendous hour and a half in his 10 minutes by saying, now we see the kind of people the Russians are and we better do something about them. See? Build up our military. And this is from reading the ending of Luke 7. That's how revolutionary Luke 7 is. Read it. That's because this gal who was a prostitute in the novel, following this man who had committed a deliberate murder because it would be the perfect crime, going out to Siberia, and they read in this overnight camp this section of Luke 7, and it rocks you. There's nothing more rocking in literature. So I just want to give a little background here for why read novels. This is all because, in a surprising sense, Paul Vaux and I were talking about this one time. He reads them, I read them. Most of the manly guys I know read novels, so don't think it's something effeminate when you do. I think that's one reason why American guys don't read novels. That's one reason. Start off with some masculine novels, John Buchan's and so on for men, or Hamonimus, or some of those. But you're missing what's happening. You're like a guy driving without his headlights on a dark night where there's no moon, and you're going to be in a ditch most of the time. In fact, you wonder how the other people actually arrive any place, and you think it's genius because somebody says something, and it happens that way. Like, for example, that we're going to be eating canned human flesh before the end of this century. I mean, this is something Anthony Burgess has in his novels, and we've got it in The Russian and so on, because if all you are is a candidate for the grave, we better eat you before you get there, that's all. It's just plain makes logic, as long as there's going to be food shortage, doesn't it? I mean, what's to keep it from happening? You think it isn't going to, maybe, huh? I mean, read the novels and see what the subterranean things are that are happening in our time. And you've got plenty of time to read them. I love this little Theology of Play by Jürgen Moltmann. It's where I've picked up this thing we've got on some of the posters around right now before the men come in, because I've never pretended that Holden Village is a necessity. I mean, I've laughed about the people down at Central Lutheran in Portland that said if God had needed it, we would have had it before. I mean, that's good Norwegian thinking. Whatever is new is of the evil one, in case you've forgotten the mother tongue. But the parish is necessary, because that's where the kingdom becomes history. But we can be meaningful. And this is a theology of play. The possibility of meaningfulness without it having to be necessary. You can live without reading these novels, fine. But the excitement of being alive to what's happened in your time won't be yours. If you haven't read Brothers Karamazov, The Grand Inquisitor, you haven't seen the parable of the 20th century that was told in the 19th, and it's been what our world wars are about. And it's why Pope John could happen, and Vatican Council II, incidentally. And as Barth says, the way he became a theologian was through Dostoevsky and Sigurd Undset. He saved him from the university professors that had taught him, and he had the greatest professors of his time. Because theology is concrete and particular like a novel. If you abstract from the particular, it's not there. It's something else. It's called philosophy. And this is why the novel is so important to us. And I love this line. I've used it earlier around here, and that's why I haven't quoted while I've been here. I don't want to tire the people that are in the village, but I think it's great. This is just a wonderful line. To put it simply, the birds are singing much more than Darwin permits, says Bute Tenjing. The birds are singing much more than Darwin permits. They don't just sing to attract a mate. They don't just sing to say, okay, this is my territory. They sing because it's fun to sing. There's a play built into the universe. In fact, the only theological kind of logic that you can possibly construct that allows God to be God is that it's out of play that he has created the universe. Otherwise, you've got a really screwed up kind of theological concept of God. It's in the playfulness of God that you exist. And as you see this, you get into this fact that there's plenty of time for you to take care of some of these things like novels. Charles Péguy is one of the grand fathers of the revival of the church in France today, which one time Jerry Pelican said if the Missouri Synod ever kicked him out, and of course now they're kicking out so many, he's got lots of company, he thought he would join the French Catholic Church. because of the excitement of this renewal. It's come out of Piggy. But Piggy has said, and this is the French, qui perd gagne, I should have you read it, some of you Frenchies here, the loser wins. This is built into existence. The loser wins. The fellow that's uptight about succeeding and every minute counts and he's going to be there, and he's lost it all because he hasn't had time enough to even enjoy the trip. And it ends in a grave, of course. And he won't go there with a chuckle. As I could see my dad go. Kind of nice to leave that with your children. The game of grace in which the loser wins and the lost are saved, the poor are filled and the rich are left empty-handed, the game of eschatological surprises in which the first shall be last and the last first, to comprehend this game of all-reversing grace may well require that we have to give up the last vestige of pride in our own achievements and free ourselves of selfishness and self-pity so that we may join in an affirmation of grace full of wonder. And so that opens up life as play. Lost in wonder, love, and praise. John Donne's All Divinity is Love and Wonder. And this is why the novels are there for us, and why not enjoy them, you see? It's worlds that come to you that you don't have to get on spaceships to visit. But they take you into whole new spaces. And the Russian soul is not the American soul, and yet in reading the Russian soul, you can see the American one. My spring poem this year that I sent to the board has gotten handed around to different people, and every once in a while I'm getting letters from crazy places where people have really kind of responded to it, because both the East and the West, we could see talking the same kind of emptiness, while the guy that is preparing for that date with a gal that night out in the country and she's fixing up the table in her hair may be where the symbol of hope is. And here in this wonderful novel of Solzhenitsyn, you get where he takes through this uptightness about life. After all, it's a great thing in a prison camp you've got time. We sort of worried about it. I only preached every 3 Sundays in prison camp. I thought, what's it going to be like when I preach every Sunday? It wasn't too long before I was preaching 3 times a week. It's in my last parish and having a good time. It isn't so tough when you're there, but it seemed like it'd be terribly tough when every 3 weeks is all I had to come up with. When I got in that kind of rhythm. We had to do 3 hours of work a day, which was physical and good, and the rest of the time we had for great conversation and reading. And it's like one of the women said as we were getting into the truck to go down to Billabit at the end, never a dull moment, only her blotties, who happens to be one of the nuts with us. So you couldn't have a dull moment. But this excitement of refreshing, stimulating each other out of our reading, which was continuous with us, is what the village is too. It's what life is, wherever we are. And then wherever we are, there is this renewal and excitement. And he shows how this happens amongst these inhabitants of a prison, shut off as they are, but the conversation is exciting. Here I'll just give a little bit from the description that he gives of his the particular central figure, and so far as it has a hero, the hero of the novel, Narazin. He has grown up as a child, and he's sure that what he's heard as a child, as Pauline Kael says here, what we believed as children in America, was this naivete that somehow, you know, the humble always were the ones who were rewarded, and the truth would always overcome the lie, etc. And he'd been living in this thinking of the Russian people as the savior of the world. 19th century Russian literature, swooning with compassion for the suffering brother, had created for Narazin and for everyone reading it for the first time the image of a haloed, silvery-haired people embodying all wisdom, moral purity, and spiritual grandeur. But that was now on the bookshelves. There was no old Russia, but the Soviet Union instead. And it was a great city. So there he seeks out. And from this cornucopia of science, success showered upon him. He found that his mind worked quickly, but there were others whose minds worked even faster, whose wealth of knowledge oppressed him. The people remained on the bookshelves. He was convinced the only people who matter are those who carry in their heads the accumulated culture of the world, encyclopedias, connoisseurs of antiquity, men who value beauty, highly educated, many-sided man. One must belong to that elite and leave failure to itself. But the war began, and he set out as a driver on a transport wagon. Clumsy, choking with shame, he rounded up horses in the pasture, bridled them, jumped on their backs. And now, what's the discovery that he makes? He's finding an artillery officer. Got his men and so on. He's got the people with him. And then he'd been arrested. During his first interrogation, in his first transit prison, in his first camp, struck dumb by these deadly blows, he'd been horrified by seeing the other side of certain members of the elite. In circumstances where firmness of character, strength of will, and loyalty to one's friends were vital to a prisoner and could determine the fate of his comrades, these delicate, sensitive, highly educated persons who valued beauty often turned out to be cowards, quick to cave in, adroit in excusing their own vileness. The man who was working with Niels Bohr in Denmark was in my group of 40, and I literally had to hold him down so he just wouldn't go to pieces to get him across the Baltic and into Germany. I mean, this sort of thing. A man by the name of Mather, the descendants of Kottmather, my best friend in prison camp, and again, I had to hold him down under the bombing or we'd just simply gone to pieces. It isn't in that kind of intelligentsia, he sees. Then he thought of the people once more. This is where it would be. And he turns to the people. Go to the people. Yet it was not quite full circle. Narazin, the educated Czech, had one advantage over our grandparents. Unlike those cultivated 19th century aristocrats, he did not have to change his clothes and feel his way down the staircase to go to the people. Who's he taking through here, by the way? The great writer whom he most resembles, actually, Tolstoy. And remember, even separated from his wife, dressed like a peasant, worked the farm, so on. Instead, he was tossed down among the people in his tattered cotton-padded trousers and soiled pea jacket in order to work as norm. Narazin shared the life of the people not as a condescending and therefore alien gentleman, but as one of them, no different from them, an equal among equals. He had to learn to drive a nail straight home to fit one board to another, not in order to ingratiate himself with the peasants, but to earn a soggy chunk of daily bread. And after the harsh apprenticeship of camp, one more of Narazin's illusions disappeared. He realized there was nowhere to go anymore. And this is underlined by the author. The bankruptcy of hope in the human potential. It turned out that the people had no homespun superiority to him. Sitting down in the snow with them at the guard's command, hiding with them from the foreman in the dark corners of a construction project, hauling barrows together in the cold, drying foot claws with them in the barracks, Narazin saw clearly that these people are of no greater stature than he. They did not endure hunger and thirst any more stoically. They were no more firm of spirit as they faced the stone wall of a 10-year term. They were no more foresighted or adroit than he during the difficult moments of transports and body searches. They were blinder and more trusting about informers. They were more prone to believe the crude deception of the bosses. They awaited amnesties, which Stalin would rather have died than give them. If some Camp Martin had happened to be feeling good and smiled, they hastened to smile back at him. And they were also greedier for petty things, for the supplementary 3 ounces of soured millet cake, for the ugly camp trousers, as long as they were a bit newer or brighter color. What was lacking in most of them was that personal point of view which becomes more precious than life itself. There was only one thing left for Narazin to do, be himself. Not by birth, not by the work of one's hands, not by the wings of education as one elected into the people, but by one's inner self. Everyone forges his inner self year after year. One must try to temper, to cut, to polish one's soul so as to become a human being and thereby become a tiny particle of one's own people, to be joined to the human race then. And this kind of renewal that comes when, as S.K. put it, Søren Kierkegaard, all I desire is honesty, simple human honesty. And that's what any authentic novel is about. And that's what helps us, as a kind of mirror to ourselves. Like Saul Bellow, nobody can write better than he. He starts out in this strong naturalism that he had, gets into Henderson the Rain King with an idealistic kind of American businessman, and finally finds himself kidding his way to Jesus, this Jew from the Chicago kind of ghetto, and kidding his way to Jesus with Mr. Samuel's Planet. As you see, the church that becomes secularized and leaves the city a dump, and nothing left for a man but his own stench. And this one old Jew who has been raised from a mass grave into which the Nazis had put him, thinking him still dead. And so he's a symbol himself of the resurrection. And his one good eye is all he has left. And he reads with its help in this particular, reading machine in the library that takes these little tapes now and exposes them. And all he's reading are the two men who brought the gospel to Luther. He doesn't know if he's believing them, but he knows that there's nothing else he wants to read. Kind of interesting, isn't it, in our own society, as he sees our own society
with its pathetic cocktail talk, with nothing left but another kind of incident in one's sexual ventures, or a little ploy and defeat of one's fellows in the particular corporation we're in. The only thing there is just this possibility of newness from God that is in the forgiveness of sin. And this is what the novels permit to happen. They can't preach it. To preach it is to forsake the novel, but they can show the barrenness and the bankruptcy, as he does here in this little story. One of the fun chapters in here is of one young girl whose revolutionary parents, who were liberals and outside the church, of course, of Russia, and they're shocked because she's now attending a service in the evangelical church in Moscow. And they question her about this, and she said, after all, she said to her parents, they are the persecuted minority now. That's where the hope is. That's where the hope is. And as we get into this kind of an understanding of life, we do realize then that it isn't the numbers that are going to win, but it's those who trust their sense of smell and their own eyes enough to say it the way they see it and smell it. And the king has no clothes. And the revolution happens when one person says this, in any place, at any time. Because as in Bread and Wine, Saloni has shown very well in novel form. One novel has been rewritten twice, wrote it once under Mussolini, once after World War II. So you can read it in both versions. But no kind of society can stand one dissenting voice when it is absolute and autocratic. Because one voice can overthrow it. And this is our confidence. This is what, unfortunately, Pauline Kael still hasn't become mature enough to see. And I love her. I think she's one of the best writers in our critical literature. I read all of her movie critiques. She's great, as far as I'm concerned. She has more sass and more acid than anybody I know, except a few Missouri Synod pastors write me letters, and I suggest to them they get into the public, because we lack for this in our society. But we're grateful for every honest voice that lets us see that where it's at isn't in our power to achieve. But in his who does speak through this kind of human suffering, with that note that is there, that there is redemption, there is a God who is more powerful than the God of the lie. And that's why it's fun. I suggest to all of you to get this novel that's finally come out now in English again. It's the best Lutheran novel, incidentally, in our century. Martin A. Hansen, The Lie. And it's simply about the emptiness of Lutheran culture. It's vapidity, it's boredom, and how it leaves us only as a spectator of where it's really happening, because we won't get where it's hurting. It's really a great novel. Martin A. Hansen, The Liar. Dean, died at 44, one of their best poets, and certainly the finest I know in our Lutheran literature in this century, for showing the emptiness of simply a concept of vocatio, vocation, that is not centered in what we heard this morning in the forgiveness of sins and the reality of Jesus Christ. This dandy teacher on a lonely island sees himself in his journal finally as the lie, because he's content to be a spectator, and even though he knows this one girl who's in his class is in love with him and marriage with her would be a risk, he doesn't take the risk. And he sees her married off to another who's not able to carry through. And he's preaching on the third Sunday in Lent when we have this tremendous passage about the one devil out and the seven more coming in, and it actually happens in the church as he's proclaiming. And it's a delightful presentation, what it means to be under the power of the lie. And that's what these novels do when they're real. This is the function of art for us all, is to give us eyes, ears, and a sense of smell. And with some courage to say, it smells, something smells here. See, like that dandy story of Laverne Reekes that he tells when he comes here about this old judge we've got in Washington who's all of 88 or 9, he can't hear or see anymore, hardly, and he's hearing his cases and he's got to make his decisions or he doesn't get his salary by the end of January. And when he hears a case and he hears the two boys, he says, something smells here, someone's lying. He says, that's why it's there in court. And you see this, and you say it. Well, that's why I find this encouragement of this kind of company of those who are hurting for the sake of truth. Well, one could quote at length, but I'm just going to close from Solzhenitsyn because that's where he brings it in. That's why he writes about those who are dying of cancer. And the ridiculousness and the humor there again is like, it's like one of West Preed's jokes of the guy that's being put in the electing chair and he says, well, this will teach me a lesson. They're dying of cancer, and, you know, and they got their dreams still of, you know, something else going on, and the political order is going to come their way and so on. And the fellows that are in prison and have nothing more. And he says, finally, when they come to the sense of bankruptcy, then they are filled, where they are filled with the fearlessness of those who have lost everything. The fearlessness which is not easy to come by, but which endures. And this is our confidence, that we who are shaped by the cross and the Christian tradition, that that's where it's happening. Pauline Kael does not shape that. I remember how the first summer here, Al Pitcher took me through for having lost power, if you were here, you know, and he was making a deal of this, and now he's going to join the powerless himself and resigning early to be with Paul Haynes community over there in Ballard. Because where it's at is in this company that is free to act under this wonder of a God who does give you the knowledge that the loser wins. We should read it, by the way, and also Howard Hong's got the same delightful kind of irony in it. It's fun. Any questions anyone asks, you can ask Leo now. Come on.